This week, Ron Gula joins us to update us on his journey in the startup world, to give you a little sneak preview. Michael and I are going to talk about some startup security news, including meaningful VC exits, building a startup accelerator at a large company, Fort Insights from analyzing 5,000 plus cap tables. That sounds absolutely fascinating, Michael. My story for this week that I want to hit is 11 free tools and services that every first-time entrepreneur should use. All that and more on this edition of Startup Security Weekly. This is a Security Weekly production.
I need it from the top. Brought to you by Tenable Network Security, creators of Nessus, the world's best vulnerability scanner. Jumpstart your security program today and evaluate Security Center CV, the continuous security monitoring solution. For more information, visit them on the web at tenable.com. IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Access over 2,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content live and on demand via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, or your mobile device. IT Pro TV's premium membership grants access to all courses, transcripts, virtual machine labs, and Transcender practice exams. Corporate and group pricing are available. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, visit itpro.tv/startup security and use the code SS30. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending these assets? Have you penetration tested them? Start 2017 by taking a proactive approach to your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting@blackhillsinfosec.com to see how they can help you sleep better at night.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Startup Security Weekly. I'm your host, Paul Assadorian, broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, on the lines via Skype. With a nice, fresh new camera. Look at Michael Santarcangelo. Wow.
I got a new camera. I got a new microphone. I feel like I'm doing play-by-play or color commentary.
Your sticky notes are straight, which is awesome.
Without a ruler. I did those without a ruler. It's, I was just taking a team through it this week. What you'll see on the other side, this side. This is my next quarter, and this side is like my next 3 weeks.
It's very, very analog of you, Michael.
It gives me something to look at every day. So, you know, when those distractions creep in and you're like, oh, I look at that and I go, no, I got to get those things done.
Nice.
And it's working, actually. I'm kind of pleased with the way it's working. I still have all my digital stuff online, but that's the way that it works. And so we got the new camera. We got better sound. Last week kind of pushed me to make some changes.
That's good. You look good. And you sound good.
Thanks.
Just a quick announcement from itpro.tv. Cybersecurity Analyst Plus, CCNA Cyber Ops, ITIL Operations Support Analysis, Penetration Testing, and more have gotten updates in the IT Pro TV network. They're still honoring their membership upgrade, so make sure you visit itpro.tv/startup security and use the code SS30 for 30% off discount for life. I don't think there's any other announcements, so we're going to jump right into our interview for this show with none other than Ron Gula, who actually got his start as a penetration tester for the NSA. He was the CEO of Network Security Wizards, and most probably know Ron from his time as CEO and co-founder of Tenable Network Security. And we'll dip a little bit into Ron's past, but also talk about Ron's new venture. Ron, welcome to the show.
Hey, Paul. Hey, Mike. Glad to be here.
It's nice to have you on this show, Ron. This is your first appearance on this show. It's very, very nice to have you. Ron was and probably still will be a frequent guest on Paul Security Weekly. I think our first interview was 2006. It was really early on in the history. Ron's got the vintage mug that he's drinking from. Very nice. Very nice.
I haven't received my Security Weekly cigar set yet, though.
That's right.
Must not come to mail yet.
You know, it's to talk about startups and such, it's really hard now with FDA regulations to release a cigar. like regulations came down, and it makes it very, very difficult. Not to say that it won't happen, but it just makes it a lot more difficult. So it's a good idea. We should do that. Ron, let's talk about kind of your first startup was Network Security Wizards, correct?
Correct. The big fan of Dungeons and Dragons, Network Security Wizards was a cool name, and the product was called Dragon. Actually, Marty Rush, the guy that did Snort, actually came up with the Dragon name.
Interesting. So in what year was that in?
It was 1999 we got started.
Wow. So like, what were some of the differences back then versus now in terms of doing a security startup?
Well, the funny thing is when we did that startup, we didn't really use any venture capital. We didn't talk to the local county. We didn't talk to, you know, people. We didn't go through an accelerator, you know, that kind of stuff. But within, you know, 18 months, we had the product deployed in the DOD at places like AOL. And they were big back then, you know, and we had acquisition offers from some of the major big, you know, players out there. Now you go to RSA and there's 1,000 companies there, and the ecosystem of the cybersecurity landscape has really just exploded over the last couple, two decades, I guess.
And then Ron, for our listeners, like, what drove you to, create Tenable Network Security?
So when we did Network Security Wizards, we sold to Enterasys Networks, and I got to go there and work for a couple of years and learn about, you know, two-tier channel distribution, international intellectual property issues, skewing services, all, you know, working with partners, all that kind of stuff. And after a couple of years there, I kind of got the itch to, you know, to basically start something else. And at the time, you know, there was the SIM market, the all the people who are doing log aggregation. But back in that time, early 2002, there was people who used many, many vulnerability tools. And of course, Nessus is the world's best, you know, vulnerability scanner. Thank you, Tenable, to sponsor this this episode. But at the time, people had one tool for Oracle, one tool for, you know, maybe a version of Solaris, one tool for a router. They had open source, they had commercial, they had multiple different tools. And so the idea originally at Tenable was to bring all that together. And you know, we quickly evolved from there.
And speaking of that evolution, you know, did you know from the start? And because I know a lot of people listening that either have startups or want to do startups, and they've got revenue goals in mind. You know, did you have like a prediction that someday you would leave when Tenable would be a $100 million plus revenue company?
I think I'm on record saying I never wanted to, you know, do things like run a public company, you know, run a company bigger than 50 people, ever deal with international sales and things like that. I like the startup stuff. But at the same time, I tell a lot of the startup companies I'm working with, you know, don't lock yourself into one plan. But you got to have that swim lane. You got to have that vision and the risk and measure your security. And 14 years later, you know, we saw the birth of PCI. We saw the birth of frameworks. We saw the huge debate of between pen testing and security auditors. And now, of course, the incident response teams look a whole lot like pen testing teams. The market has really, really moved on. But the original concept of Tenable, having an obtainable and defendable network, is still true to this day.
Michael, do you have questions for Ron? I know I'm very curious as to your questions for Ron. Because Ron and I have obviously known each other for quite a while now. So,
well, I mean, there's two things that I think are interesting just based on your experience, which is, How much did you learn the first time around that you were able to bring into Tenable, and how much changed then between that, right? And then the follow-up question that I'm also curious about, because you just talked about never wanted to be big, never wanted to be public, never wanted all those things. And sometimes what we see in a startup is some people don't make those transitions very well, but you did. So I'm kind of curious what that journey was like.
Yeah, so a lot of what I did before Network Security Wizards – I did for other people, right? So I worked at the NSA as a pen tester, so I got to learn the hard way about, you know, measuring risk and doing pen testing. I got to work at BBN, where we did things like honeypots and quickly development of tools for a variety of government customers. But I kind of learned how to roll out products and, you know, write proposals and demonstrate products to customers. And then I got to go to work at US Internetworking, was really one of the first cloud type companies in Annapolis, Maryland. And I got to learn about how to talk to customers about, look, you know, frankly, we know better than you how to host your data. And, you know, that's a rough conversation back then. How you say that and how you sell that is kind of interesting. And then, of course, doing Network Security Wizards, selling that, seeing Enteris's networks competing against people like Cisco. By the time we started Tenable, I had seen a lot. And so a lot of the decisions we made about growing, a lot of the decisions we made about, you know, what went into the product, it was because we kind of we didn't have to really debate about it a whole lot. We kind of knew it from experience, whether it came to pricing. You know, gee, what does a penetration tester, what would they pay for Nessus? You know, what kind of value would we have to do? That's a pretty natural type of discussion to have. And a lot of times when we work with startups, if they don't have that background, that's when we say, look, you really got to get some advisors. You got to get some board members. You got to hire some product. You got to have people in your organization who know the customers that you're dealing with and the problem first set. That's one of the first things I look for as a potential investor in a company. Do the founders, does the team have a sense of what the market is and what the market wants?
So does that mean, so let's stand up for a second, because that's an interesting thread we've had recently, which is, do you value, in fact, I think what Paul and I have been kind of vectoring in on is, if you have that experience yourself as a founder, or if you have that experience in your team, great, run with it. But if you don't, you've got to acquire it. You've got to get it either through an advisor or a hire or something else. So when you're looking at that, do you tend to stay then looking at investments where you know you can assess their knowledge, whether it's they can talk a good game or they actually understand it?
Yeah. You can fix product. You can't fix teams. You know, if you have a team that's got the wrong product with the wrong approach and the wrong pricing or the wrong marketing or the wrong message, you can fix that. But if the team is not the right team, you know, you can replace the team, and that's there's some venture capital firms out there that have no problem going in and, you know, gutting all the founders and, you know, firing the head of sales and things like that, because you can. That's not my style. I'm very entrepreneur focused, so I tend to invest in the entrepreneur who's got the right technology or the close enough technology is the way I look at it.
And speaking of which, Ron, when you were departing Tenable, there was much rumbling about what's Ron Gulag going to do? And that official announcement came recently in the past couple of weeks. So why don't you share with our listeners what you're up to?
Yeah, so contrary to popular belief, I've not been to Trump Tower or anything like that. we're launching Gula Tech Adventures, and it's a fund where we're investing just like another venture capital firm would, but our focus is really what I would consider seed investing or Series A in investing. And that really means, you know, entrepreneurial cybersecurity startups, 2 to 10 people who maybe have come out of an incubator, maybe it's their second or third time doing a company, and they're looking for a little bit of capital and perhaps some advice. And then when I say we, actually, my wife, Cindy Gula, she was actually involved not only with Network Security Wizards, but she was the first employee at Tenable Network Security, and, you know, was one of the keys to our growth and success at both endeavors.
That's fantastic. So your Gula Tech Adventures is not focused on the incubation so much as it is the seed in Series A, correct?
You know, in all honesty, where I live in Maryland, I looked really hard at starting an incubator. My wife and I spent some time with a lot of companies around here that are doing incubation, whether it's acceleration, you know, helping people training basic. And that just wasn't we weren't drawn to that. And we were really, really drawn to the seed level Series A. You know, can we help a company get off the ground, get to profitability, you know, get to their minimum viable product, you know, that sort of thing. So that's really where I think we can help people avoid the mistakes that we may have made and, you know, succeed.
Ron, you always had a very keen sense for security companies and which ones were more interesting than the other. And over the years, you and I have had lots of conversations about new technologies or new solutions. And you always had like this short list of, well, you know, this company's doing this. Are there some tips for, Michael and I, right, to be able to track those, but also for people doing startups, like how do they find their niche and kind of get on your radar or other investors' radar?
Well, one of the reasons we did the website was so we're easy to find. And so it's gulatechadventures.com, and, you know, we have ways to contact us. But we're also present in a lot of these, you know, incubation days. I was at the Mach 37. Mm-hmm. They had a launch day late last year, for example. And we try to be visible. But as far as, you know, what we're trying to look for and what's interesting, you know, the rules are still kind of the same, even though I'm going to give a talk in another month called The Rules of Change. But, you know, you have confidentiality, integrity and availability, right? So if you have a better way to transform doing those things, whether it's in the cloud, on a mobile device, on a desktop, great. Change the world, go out and conquer. I'm working with a number of companies who think that they're going to be really big and literally change the way we do security. On the other hand, and not to take anything away from that, there's a lot of processes that we're doing that we've been doing for a long time. Network intrusion detection, log aggregation, running a security operations center. If you have a way to use automation to save money, to do it cheaper, to do it faster, you know, you might not change the way the world does cybersecurity, but you're going to be able to have a very, very successful business. So anytime you can do things in either of those areas, I get interested and I get excited, because I think there's still a lot of opportunity for not only people to have successful cybersecurity companies, but to actually help people save money or actually be secure.
One of the things that I'm actually struggling with right now is, and not just in my own venture, but in looking at other companies as well, is I feel like enterprises specifically want a solution that solves multiple problems and does a lot of things, and they want to buy from one vendor. However, a lot of startups, even with some funding, can really only focus on a niche or a specific problem. And I feel like a lot of companies do that really well, but it's a smaller part of the picture. So in your investing, like, how do you factor that in? And then what's your recommendation for folks buying products in terms of going with a niche product or going with a larger solution?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different go-to-markets, right? You've got large enterprise, you've got commodity, you've got services, you've got B2B. There's so many different ways that you can add value to an organization's ability to have business confidence in what they're doing, or, you know, reduce their cost of, you know, demonstrating compliance, that it's really interesting. Now, on the enterprise, you mentioned that. I do think that enterprise products need to have a lot of features. But if you think about something like the Gartner Magic Quadrant, or all of the controls that are involved with PCI or SANS, the Center for Internet Security, you know, critical security controls, even the NIST Cybersecurity Framework, an enterprise is not going to buy one product that does all of that stuff. So we've seen a lot of enterprise products that are rewarded for being best in class. CyberArk, for example, probably the most successful company in identity management. If they got into antivirus, if they got into log aggregation, the market's probably not going to reward them. Mm. Splunk, awesome. Log aggregation, log analysis, business intelligence. If they got into doing things like firewalls or something like that. So my point is in the enterprise, people tend to reward organizations and companies who are really good at what they do and have all the features that an enterprise organization would demand. Mm. Now, when you go SMB, when you go small, when you go cloud, those rules get flipped around. You can have a SIM in the cloud, and people seem to think it's awesome if you can do carbon black type telemetry in addition to the logs and do some network forensics. It's sort of that lower end, and I don't mean higher or low, but the opposite of large scale enterprise. There's less budgets, there's less people. So the more boxes you can check in your solution, the more likely a customer might buy what you're doing just because of price. And, you know, every vertical is slightly different, right? Energy, finance, government, there's different shades of those type of things. So there's plenty of opportunity because everybody's getting hacked. Everybody has a budget for cyber. And, you know, there's a lot of competition to outdo the other folks. This is capitalism at its best.
When you invest in companies, is it primarily cloud-based solutions? And do you find that the market is responding better to solely cloud-based solutions versus on-premise?
So when I invest, I'm interested in a number of things. Can I work with the team, and can I make a difference? And is it going to be a good investment? Now, is it going to be the next Uber? I would like to think every company I is going to be that. But the reality is you know, a lot of companies that are going to RSA, for example, you know, they might be a great addition to, you know, somebody like a Cisco, somebody like a Microsoft. But as far as cloud versus on-prem or service versus perpetual, there's still a lot of opportunities. I just came from a meeting with a potential investment where they're still kind of in perpetual, but they're moving to subscription. So as much as the internet and people like to talk about how everything's moving to the cloud, there's a lot of people that still have legacy, large Windows networks. And, you know, solving security problems for that network is just as exciting as, you know, solving security problems for people who have 100% SaaS and, you know, Amazon Rackspace is your, you know, development applications.
Ron, in your opinion, what are some of the elements in a great pitch?
Brevity. If somebody can do a pitch in one slide, that's what I love. I mean, brevity, focus, you know, if they can tell me the problem, what they do, you know, why they're unique, you know, if they can, you know, sort of withhold themselves from doing the background pitch or or telling me why the director of engineering is so good at managing people, you know, those are things, the details. And those are the things you get excited about after the pitch. But brevity is the best thing of a pitch. Mm.
Go
ahead, Michael.
I'm sorry, Paul. Would you like? I've been doing a lot of work lately on understanding the sales process and cold calling. Would you liken the pitch then? It's almost like to that cold call. You've got a very short window to show that you can bring value, differentiate yourself, and get interest in more conversation.
Mm-hmm. And if you can do that in one slide, I tend to appreciate that. Now, in practice, you know, a great pitch is like 3 slides, 4 slides.
I was just going to say, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But what I think what you're also pointing out is if somebody's taken the time to distill and they've thought it through and they carefully use their words, that also shows that they're pretty tight, right? I mean, that's because if you're looking for somebody that understands the customer, understands the marketplace, is a well put together team. So when you see a pitch, are you usually just expecting one person to do the pitch? Or if it's a team, are you kind of evaluating how they operate together? Or is that a secondary thing? Just show me your idea first. If it's interesting, then we'll go forward.
So it's kind of interesting because there's a lot of different things that can happen with a company who's offering products. You know, perhaps they had to pivot. You know, perhaps there's regulations that have changed. Like for example, we saw FanDuel, you know, kind of come and go last year. So companies who were getting into online sports betting, maybe they had to do a pitch, a switch in their go to market. So their pitch is changing. Maybe there's some technology there, and the technology does something, but the pitch is completely wrong. And you know, so my point is that you know, I would love to see the perfect pitch is one slide, and it's a hook, line, sinker, and yeah, let me invest. But you know, the reality is maybe I can help a company not only by providing them some capital, but helping them with their pitch, or thinking about adjacent markets, or thinking about ways to take the technology that they have and talk about it where there's a different buyer. Maybe sometimes I get excited because I know that this company just needs a little bit of help and it would be a perfect acquisition for some other company. And that's so as an investor, I'm looking for opportunity. But people ask, you know, how can I do a sexy pitch? Boy, brevity in one slide and try to have all the nuance so you can get differentiation, demonstration of market value and market command. And just some level of excitement. Those are the kind of things I like to see.
You know what I'm loving is listening to you explain that. It's you're demonstrating why it's so important for somebody seeking money to also do diligence on the other side. Somebody who needs some of that what you're offering them with your experience, your background, and your current focus is, hey, these are the situations in which I fit. And that's really helpful for them to start to figure out how to better pitch you or not. That feels exciting to me in this space because I think that there's a lot of people in security that have really good ideas but probably need a little bit of that help. And it sounds like with your experience, you'd like the perfect pitch out of the gate, but you're also willing to listen a little bit and say, oh, there's something here, and maybe see if you can polish it off a little bit and then help them along the way. I don't know. I like that. That's exciting. I'm excited that you're doing that, Ron.
And there's all these kind of analogies of, you know when you invest in a company – they might offer you a board seat. They might say, let's have you as an advisor. But the reality is can you have a conversation and can you get some mutual feedback there? Because as much as I've done this for 20 years, I don't know everything. So if I'm asking a dumb question, well, how do they handle, you know, a dumb question? Or if I'm asking a question and they don't know the answer to that, or they've never thought about that, how do they respond to criticism, you know, perhaps in their go-to-market or things like that. And that's a very personal thing, and not everybody is a fit to together. So I'm also looking for, you know, is there an opportunity to work together? Is there an opportunity to have two-way, you know, every time I talk to them.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I've seen this a lot on Shark Tank, right? It's usually Mark Cuban that, and others too, that make the decision. Like, I kind of feel like he feels like there would be too much work involved in getting the company where it needs to be. Where are your thresholds in that, Ron? Like, where do you see yourself as a role in helping companies? And then, like, what's the cutoff where you're like, well, maybe that's not the right fit?
Right. So there's a couple interesting things. As a potential investor, you know, I'm not a potential CEO. I tell people right away, I'm not looking to get back. And I did that for 20 years. I'm not looking to get back in that seat. So if somebody needs a CEO, if somebody needs a management team, you know, and that's the thing that's holding them back. Maybe they're a brilliant technical person, but we got to find that person a CEO. That might be a requirement before I invest.
Gotcha.
Another one could be, look, they've got a great technology. They tend to know what they're doing, but they really need capital, right? They need $4 million. They need a real Series A. I might hold back and say, look, I'm not going to put any money in at all, and I'll try to participate maybe with the Series A or B. Well, the Series A, when somebody else puts that capital in and, you know, commits to supporting that company with the network of that. So as much as, you know, people say, hey, it's Ron Gula, he's been in the industry, he knows everybody. The reality is if you have a VC who's, you know, managing a 50 to 500 million or billion dollar fund, you know, they've got teams of people who can do things. Like, for example, Insight, you know, they helped us a lot after they did the investment in Tenable. You know, they literally had dinners where they would organize, you know, 20 or 30 CIOs to show up, and, you know, we got to speak at and things like that. So there's a lot of benefits that mm-hmm. we're trying to have in this type of ecosystem. But those are some of the things we'll hold back on if we don't see a complete picture.
So what other kind of benefits and advice do you give the companies that you invest in, like once you've finalized the investment, and just break that down in terms of, like, you know, business process or marketing or just, you know, general introductions? Like, do you have a kind of standard list of things that you help your companies that you're investing in?
Yeah, I try to go for the next easy thing. Like something that doesn't work is like, okay, hey, Ron, we're ready to go to market. Can you introduce us to 100 customers? Because that's not what I'm there for. Like, I tell people usually, I'm upfront, you know, who we invest in, and I'm a little bit I'm getting more public about it, but I'm not sort of the number one salesperson for, you know, for the folks that we do. But, you know, if somebody's, like, for example, if somebody's in an evaluation at a bank and I know the CISO, I'll call the CISO and say, hey, look, did you know that this company's in there? I don't know if they're on your radar yet. Because that's what you really need when you're starting out. You need good, solid customers and real feedback. And what you don't need is somebody, you know, if they're evaluating three cloud SIM companies, and, you know, they're just testing the water. I would love to know that before, you know, a startup with limited time and energy, you know, spends a lot of money and effort, you know, going in there. You know, at the same time, there's so many other ways to be useful when it comes to introducing people to marketing. For example, if somebody doesn't want to hire a marketing person, you know, what could we do? What are you trying to get? Are you trying to get, you know, leads? Do you want a speaking event where we can get people to come in? There's a lot of opportunity to just participate in things like the CCDC, mm-hmm. In different types of events, you know, all across the country.
Recruiting is a big challenge, I think, for startups as well. How do you help the companies you invest in finding talent?
Yeah, two ways. So the one pitch I do is saying, if anybody says, what kind of regrets do I have from doing Security Wizards and Tenable? It's not going fast enough. So the way that manifests with recruiting is I tell people, think about the org chart for the next level. Like, well, how do you envision the company 2 years from now, 3 years from now? And then what's holding you back from having that org chart today? Because a lot of times what people do is they're opportunistic. They hire a great engineer who's really a product manager who's also doing QA. And what happens is they get successful with having a mix of roles that overlap. And I say, look, when you think about recruiting, especially when you're going out and raising that Series A, if you can say, here's the org chart we're putting in place, these are the type of people we need, here's the people we have now, here's how it fills in, it changes your focus and your mindset, and it makes it a lot easier to do the recruiting, because you have very, very specific, you know, roles and expectations of what these things are. Once you have that, boy, it's a lot easier to articulate to somebody how you want them to work in your organization and what your organization as a startup is going to look like 2 years and 3 years from now. Just having that focus of knowing what you want really makes recruiting a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Michael, more questions for Ron?
I'm soaking this in. Here's the one I have. I'd listen to you. The difference between seed round versus an A or something else, it sounds like you don't have a hard or fast rule, but would it be fair to say that if somebody's coming to you for a seed round, you don't mind putting in the time, but you've got to be excited about them as a team, feel like you can contribute, and really like the problem they're solving and their solution to it. Whereas as an A round, if someone else has helped them get to that point where they can see it and then you can see it, you're a little bit more excited. Is that a fair way to explain the difference?
Yeah, I mean, the difference between seed and A is really, you know, you're getting revenue, you're getting some customers. Usually by the time you're A, a lot of people who invest want to see $1 million in revenue or yep. $5 million in revenue. It depends on the market and what you're doing. But there's the transition from A to B. Now, remember, this is a guy who didn't raise any money for his first company and waited 10 years to raise money for his second company. So I love very much also companies who are thinking about just getting profitable and just growing the company organically. And that's a completely different conversation. I'm having that conversation with a lot of people. But, you know, if you're going to have to go out and build that org chart like I was talking about, you really, you know, you can't just print money. You've got to go and either build that knowing what revenue you've got coming in or get an investor who's going to give you some, some capital to do that. Where I kind of am pulling back from is if somebody wants to do a B round or a C round and they're just raising $50 million or, you know, silence, they just raised $100 million. You know, I'm not going to add a lot from a capital point of view, but, you know, to advise or getting involved with somebody at that stage, that's a very, very big commitment. One of the interesting things about seed round and A round, they don't have that many resources, so you're not on the phone with them every day. So I can be a lot more effective with a broader...
Oh, it's interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's one of the big reasons I'm focusing on this area here, because I've had a lot of people say, hey, Ron, let's go raise, you know, a lot of money. The biggest number somebody's thrown out is $500 million. And there's funds like that out there. And some of them come from people in industry, but very rarely do you have a principal at those funds who's an ex-CEO of a public right. cybersecurity company or a company the size of Tenable. But I wouldn't want to do that because it takes a lot of time to advise somebody who's perhaps pre-IPO or, you know, breaking $100 million in revenue. There's just so many moving parts at scale. That's not something I'm drawn to. I'm really drawn to the people who are starting out $1 million to $5 million in revenue and that sort of thing.
So, Ron, a lot of people listening are like, oh, I want to pitch Ron. I'm not sure what your schedule looks like, but obviously they can go to your website and contact you. Is that correct?
Yeah, brevity. And if they can fit it into a tweet, that's even better, right?
Yeah. Nice. I like it.
So, I mean, just for anybody who does want to do that, so we're really trying to focus on cybersecurity. So, like, for example, we've been pitched data center cooling, great company. Somebody wanted to just save energy in data centers. I'm all for that. That's not my area of expertise. Don't want to do that. I'm trying to be fairly disciplined about sticking to what we know and doing that. But yeah, but anybody who wants to contact me, go to Gula Tech Adventures. It's investor@gula.tech. Send the note. If you're on LinkedIn with me, link in that way. And really interested in doing that. And then we have a small list of the portfolio companies that we're working with there. And if you think you're competitive with them, maybe we don't want to talk to you. But, you know, a lot of people realize that there's more than one way to skin a cat. And even if you've got a competing type of solution, it still might be a different vertical or a different go-to-market that still would make sense.
Hmm. Good advice. Ron, thank you very much for appearing on Startup Security Weekly.
And thank you guys for focusing on this. This is one of the resources I wish I had when I was starting out.
Excellent. Thanks, Ron. We'll be right back.
LogRhythm's Netmon Freemium delivers real-time network visibility to quickly identify emerging threats in your IT environment. Netmon Freemium is a free commercial-grade network forensics and traffic analytics solution. You can use Netmon Freemium's powerful capabilities to search against all of observed network traffic, identify abnormal traffic patterns and application usage, and quickly analyze full packet captures. Take the first step towards real-time network visibility. Visit logrhythm.com/freemium to learn more and download it today.
Welcome back, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. Michael's here with us, coming off the heels of the interview with Ron Gula. Very different interview from interviews of the past. I wish Ron nothing but success. It's really awesome.
Well, I got to say, you know, he made a really key point that I loved, which is there's not a lot of people out there that were CEOs of security companies, and he's been doing this for so long. He's just got fantastic insights to it, and that's why I was really kind of curious on – okay, so somebody with his experience, how do you decide A round versus C round? What is it that you're looking for? Because I think there's a lot of people out there that would really benefit from some of that insight that he shared. So that was a blast. It was great.
Yeah, it's awesome. We've got some awesome stories to talk about as well. Michael, why don't you kick us off?
Well, yeah. So the first one, you know, and these are going to keep following some of the themes that we looked at, but. Right. So last time we talked about the gap. Is there a post-seed gap? And are we finding that there's less money or is the pie changing or whatever else? And it turns out that the answer is not so much. I mean, and then, yeah, kind of it's changing a little bit. So the idea here is you need to demonstrate to somebody, if you want them to write you a check, that you've got a good product market fit. You know, I'm going to add some of my own words to it, but I mean, because their argument here, and we've talked about this, and I'm not sure I buy into it. I mean, let me be fair. I buy into the numbers in terms of total investment. So it says first quarter of 2016, U.S. venture investment dropped 30% from its $17.3 billion peak in the second quarter of 2015. And so now we've got, you know, less money and it's still up for grabs and there's more companies and so there's lower funding. That's scaremongering. And what we find, it's kind of like if you're in an enterprise today and you say, oh, well, I don't have budget for that. If you're in an enterprise today, there's funding. There's always funding. If you're in a Fortune 250, at any given point, you can go make a case and get $250K if you know how to. I think it's the same thing here. And this is kind of what it points out. It says you got to have a product market fit. And I think that's what Ron was just explaining. You have to be able to come in and say to somebody, I understand the marketplace, and here's how we're going to solve it. And I break it down to, here's a problem that people have that they recognize that they're willing to give us money because we can solve it, and here's the proof. And I think what we see a lot of times with startups is they don't do that. And I think it's important in security to remember, instead of just saying, oh, I found this nifty way of doing X, you have to follow up and say, does the marketplace understand that it has problem X? And does your solution naturally fit that problem? Yes? Awesome. And then when you can explain that to somebody who's willing to invest in your company, I think you do a little bit better. Now, what they did was they said, all right, so here's a couple things. They give four metrics. Ever-growing monthly recurring revenue. Sure. Because what it's basically saying is every month you're attracting more people. Now, what I like about this is, you know, they do say, okay, like this one says, look, I want if you want a million or more, my firm wants you to have $20,000 MMR, 20% month over month MMR growth. That's actually, I think, pretty reasonable. But if you remember one or two episodes ago, we talked about just get to 1,000 a month, right? And that's the thing we're talking about. So get to 1,000 a month. Once you're at 1,000 a month, can you get to two? Once you get to two, can you get to four, right? So it's looking at something that basically shows that you're doing it. Gross margin is always good. But then what they also look at, and it's interesting because some people don't agree with this, but they said low churn is good. I like it, especially when you're young. But then strong lifetime value. This is really tough for a lot of people to figure out. It's one of those things I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around with straight talk. But, you know, so somebody has come in and they've paid you something. Cool. Well, do they renew? Do they come back? Do they upsell into other things? And understanding the lifetime value of a customer becomes really important. I think if you're going for money from somebody else, you need to show them that you have that traction, right? This is traction. And that the people who come and give you money, they stay. You're getting more money every month. and you know how much on average each of these customers is worth to you. If you do that, you're in really good shape. Now, it's easy to say. I think it's a little tough to do on the other side. So I thought this was interesting because it's a different way of looking at how does what you do matter.
Well, and you know, I want to talk about growth for a moment. I had a story in there, Michael, about Opaque Networks, and it ties into what you were just saying. They took a $21 million Series A round, and they seem to be focused on just given what they do. The article isn't very good at explaining it, but they're a cloud security service, security as a service company, which tells me likely, let's just pretend, for example, that their target market is what we deem as the SMB, right? And I think that's a generic term, but let's just say it's a smaller company, right? It's falling outside of that Fortune 1000, Fortune 2000 company type companies. And when you grow, as you said, your customers are going to grow. Do they need to grow into a larger enterprise solution? Are they going to outgrow your product? And then if that's the case, is your plan to sell to more SMBs? And are SMBs going to get larger and outgrow your product? Like, what's your strategy for growth in that scenario? Was something interesting that I've been kind of thinking about.
That's a great point. Yeah. I mean, if you've picked a niche and you've picked a market, do you have, right? People always talk about scale, but what you're also talking about too is transition. If you're in a particular market segment and it's a tight segment, I mean, I don't mean it's small. I just mean it's a tightly understood segment. Do you have the ability to play in other segments? And then, you know, what I would add as a dimension to that, Paul, is if somebody says, oh, yeah, right, let's go back to our favorite. It's now a complete show because we're going to bring up Shark Tank. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs what I do. We could help the world. Uh-huh. Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are some things that legitimately say, well, look, most organizations, most industries, most whatever deal with this challenge – I think you need to be able to articulate how, why, and for how long you really need to focus on the primary one before you can transition to either expanding your operation or negotiating some sort of a handoff, a partnership on it. So it's going to be interesting to see how that turns out.
Absolutely. Let's talk about one of your other stories. This mine kind of tie together. So you pick, Michael.
Well, the thing that's interesting, and I didn't want to press Ron on this because he only kind of danced over it to said, you know, everybody's looking for the unicorn, the Uber, or that really big exit from the company. And I know we've got some other folks going to be coming on the show this year talking about what it is that they look for. Typically, what most people will tell you is they want a 10x return in 5 years. So if they put $1 million in, they want a $10 million exit 5 years out. Of course, at the same time, they also know that 50% of those funds are going to fail. Two or three of those might get you a 3X or even a 1X, and then, you know, one or two gets you 20X, 30X, right? And so if they're institutionally investing or they're taking a much more broader discipline approach, they're going to balance that out. But what I think is interesting on this is it kind of plays it out. It says, okay, so let's go take a look at what a meaningful exit is. So it says early stage venture fund is going to invest in 20 companies. They're looking to get a 3x gross return, and they're going to charge a 2-20 fee structure. So basically, it's basically showing you how they're going to get their money on it. And about 1/3 is going to be a loss, 1/3 is going to be their money back, and 1/3 is going to be the successes. And then that means 1 is a home run, and 5 are meaningful. So basically, it comes down and it says, look, don't get really kind of freaked out about this, but it means then that based on the size of the fund, here's what it is that they're looking for. Here's why it matters. If you're looking at a bigger fund, if you want to be considered meaningful, if you want to be part of their success stories, your exit has to be bigger. So you can't go in and say, oh, yeah, I'm shooting for 10X. Yeah, totally 10X. Right? And the Grant Cardones of the world are like, 10X it all the way. Because most of us in life are like, well, if I 1X this, that's great. If I 2 or 3X it, I'm locking it up. And he's like, no, 10X it. But when you're looking at something like this, what they're basically saying is you've got to shoot to be that home run because the bigger the fund, the bigger the exit required to be meaningful. And that's just something to keep in mind. So it's just giving people some understanding. And then it goes through a couple more numbers and really starts to explain it. And really what it boils down to then is, so how fast can you grow? Now, if you notice, that's a theme we keep talking about, right? It's speed to market. What did Ron say? What was one of his biggest lessons? I would have gone faster. One of my biggest lessons of last year was, if you think you're not ready but you're close, okay, it's too late. Go. Go now. Just hustle and run. And we keep seeing people like, well, how fast can you learn? How fast does this go? And this is what this is saying is, and in fact, this is their lead final bullet point. Not every company can grow quickly enough to generate venture scale returns. And that's nothing. That's not a problem. But VC should only invest in the companies that have that potential. So if you're going after VC funding, can you convince them that you have that potential? Yeah. Good. And go after it. I mean, I see it as a call to arms, but it's also it's giving our audience a little bit more insight into some of the numbers and some of the breakdown. And this is an article worth going through and spending some time and looking at the numbers and maybe working them out by hand yourself and looking at it in the context of your organization, or if you're in the enterprise, looking at one of the startups that we see or that we showcase every week.
Yeah, I also found this article interesting, the lessons learned from Target.
Well,
specifically, like looking for winning teams, not just ideas. I find that interesting because I find a lot of investors they kind of go back and forth on the value of the team. Ron seemed to put a very high value on the team. And then if he has confidence in the team, if there are other issues and they're totally fixable, you know, that's a win for him. And that was an interesting perspective that I hadn't gotten from before from watching things like Shark Tank and talking to other investors. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, but part of the reason I put this one too is just because we keep looking at the fact, and this is one of the things I'm enjoying about our conversations. It's not always institutional investors. There are people like Ron entering into the space, which I think is great for security companies, but we've also seen that big companies are doing it. And as Strat pointed out, you know, some are doing it well and some are paying it lip service. Some are really developing it. Some are doing it because it's an acquisition. And what was kind of interesting is that, you know, Target ran theirs for the summer. And so they've got applications they're going on right now, and they're trying to figure out how to push those types of things through. But, you know, again, like take a look at how this looks, you know, coming at it. Recruit based on fit, build for the teams, and figure out how you can scale. There you go. Mm-hmm. But what I'll point out, though, too, because I get a lot of people who always ask me, they'll look at what I do and they'll say, but Michael, right now, isn't this a lot of this is based on you. How are you going to scale? And what I've realized is sometimes that's a distraction. So if you're in that really earlier stage of stuff, it's absolutely worth knowing that there's 2, 3, 4 different pathways to be able to scale. So you don't wave the question off, oh, stop. I don't. But also don't get lost in the details. What you say, or what I'm learning to say, is, yeah, I totally understand. So here's how it's looking. I'm looking to do X, Y, and Z, and then I'm going to segment in tiers. So there's a piece of me that doesn't scale, and that's going to work with a very small group of people that can afford that. But then here's all the things we can do at scale, and here's how I'm learning to build that, and here's what that looks like. Oh, and we'll certify other people to do it, and we'll and then people go, oh, okay, cool. Once you can give them something quick, it's you know, to Ron's point, it's like a one slide overview. But can you scale? Yep, here's how. Now, in terms of speed to scale, to be fair, I probably got to do a little bit better on that in my own explanations. But then go back to focusing on whatever it is you're focusing on. So, like, I would say scale matters, and the ability to scale matters. Having a good product matters more. So to me, this is an early, did we think? It's kind of like we always say with minimum viable security. Did I think about security? Yeah, check, good. Did I think about how we're going to scale? Yeah, check, good. You don't want to get to the point where you got a good product where it goes, that's awesome, how does it scale? And you go, oh, how does it scale? Yeah, you don't want to do that. So I thought it was good. And to me, this is just another example of people looking at different opportunities and different ways to support the startups and to benefit from them and to learn. And for startups looking for some way to jump into a summer round of an accelerator, and we've got some more that's going to be coming up on that too. I liked it. I thought it was useful.
All right. What else you got, Michael?
Well, the four key insights was interesting. So it's one of these. Again, this is going to be one of those things to take a look at. But here's what I thought was interesting. So the headlines: four key insights from analyzing 5,000 plus cap tables. So they're looking at the company equity status reports. And so what they basically did was they said, okay, we figured out four things that we thought were interesting. Average dilution by stage is highly predictable. Founders often own far less at exit than they might think. Star performers and average performers have wildly different experiences, and later rounds don't always translate to increased returns for founders. Here's why I thought it was interesting. First of all, anytime somebody goes and breaks down information and presents it this way, I'm fascinated by it. And to be fair, I'd like to actually go download some of this now and really kind of put my way through it a little bit. But the first part about the average dilution by stage is highly predictable. I thought that was interesting because, right, think about it. When you start the company, you have 100% of the ownership. Even if it's just, you know, it's you and a team of founders, you start with the whole pie. And one of the things that I've noticed in a lot of startups, and I don't mean this to sound like it's a small-minded, but people who are new to it will say, well, why would I ever take money from somebody else? Then I don't have any left for me. And what I've always tried to do with my kids when we sit, and you see this always come up in Shark Tank, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, you came into Shark Tank, you're asking for some huge dollars, and I'm willing to give you 10% return. What? But what happens is, what I've always said to my kids, just to keep it simple, is do you want to own 100% of something that does $1 million a year, or do you want to own 50% of something that does $100 million a year? And as they've understood math, they go, well, 50% of $100 million a year is better. They go, right, there you go. So the point is, what this is saying, though, is you do need to think about the effects of dilution, but here's the good news. It's actually pretty predictable, and it breaks it down by, you know, when you go through your series and then your series A and C and D and so on, and kind of how that works out. And it's got a lot of like really specific stuff and formulas. What I was more interested in is it's a lot more predictable than we think. So if this is something you're interested in, something you're concerned about, something, any of those elements, here, somebody has now done the work and they've said, you know what, this works pretty predictable. Here you go. You can go take a look at it. But the other one that I thought was really kind of interesting is that the star performers and the average performers have wildly different experiences. So, right, so there's a difference between the mean and the median, right? The mean is the average, and the median is actually closer to the middle, so it adjusts for any of the outliers or anything else. And basically what it says is that, you know, if you are an outlier, you might actually crush this. So the valuations, and they've got a chart that just kind of shows you that, you know, a lot of companies – have moderate valuations, but there's a long tail of companies that have significantly higher valuations, and it basically says, look, the gap begins right at the series seed, and it persists all the way through the stages. And so it confirmed something that a lot of people, and this is more of an insider, so this was news to me, I was just curious about it, a relatively small percentage of companies command the highest valuations. Most companies receive significantly lower valuations than the top performers. So this is something we've commented on, this next part. Receiving $1 billion valuation is an extremely rare event for a startup. It's why they're called unicorns. Yeah, but what it also does, and this is interesting, is it has a stronger outlook for the employees. And then it goes into a lot of details on that. So the two things I think are interesting on this. If you're in that space where you're looking to work for a startup, understanding where their valuation is on a median distribution, not a mean distribution, is insightful to you to try to make better decisions around what the outlook might look like for you or what it might look like for the company. But here's the other thing too. If you're on that startup side and you're looking at VC investment, you know, just because you look at it and say, well, the average investment is now $10 million, right? That could mean nothing. Go look at a median distribution. Go look at the report that they've put together. Go look at that detail. And then, by the way, don't get hung up in those numbers. I have now, in the last couple months, because I've really been paying attention to it, I'll find a seed round that goes anywhere from $50 to $1 million. I'll look at a Series A that goes anywhere from $500,000 to $5 million. And we've seen a couple Series A's that were $10 and $12 and $15 million. So go build a company. Go understand your market fit. Go figure out what your value is. And then go make the best possible case you can that lets somebody confidently give you what you need. And understanding dilution and understanding all these other types of things is going to set you up to be more effective. So I thought it was interesting because it's a big group of data, and I think they did a nice job breaking it down.
I want to transition, Michael, and talk about some other things that are not so much about the business and investment side of it, I should say, but more about like tools for investors and a really cool startup. And you had one on further distance your business from cyber attacks. It was, you said it was a horrible list.
Yeah, it's, you know, listen, I try so hard. I always want to be positive. There's too much negativity out there.
I agree.
So when I'm on a startup site and I say, you know, and it's got a cyber thing, I kind of feel like it's an obligation to go look at it. And so, you know, that title is 9 Ways to Further Distance Your Business from a Cyber Attack. And I go, okay, it's kind of interesting. And then I read it. Here's how it reads. Create company-wide security policies. Conduct continuous cybersecurity audits. Choose secure passwords. Contract white hat hackers. Work with the FBI.
That's a weird
Train
one.
Your employees. Stay up to date. Learn from the mistakes of others. Start with the basics. Here's why I think this is a completely useless article. I didn't learn a damn thing from that. I've been doing this for 20 years, and that's not advice I would give to anybody, because that is advice that sounds really good. Hey, Paul, I mean, you got your policies, right? And you started with the basics. And 9 times out of 10, they're going to go, they're either going to say, yeah, totally. They're going to go, what the hell does that mean?
Right.
And then when they say, wait, what do you mean by the basics? We can have a start. I guarantee you right now, across the whole Security Weekly platform, we can have a weekly, here's your top 10 basics for probably the next 10 to 15 weeks, and never have the same 10 items in the list.
Mm-hmm.
And argue passionately and accurately that those are the basics. We don't have any freaking clue yet in this industry how to do that. And frankly, it's suggesting to me, if you're a startup, that you start by having policies and you do consistent audits. What?
No, I think the advice for
point.
The advice for startups is, first, don't read this article. Second, yeah. is to build good architecture into it. Let's look at, you know, there's lots of different aspects of security, but let's look at your product first. If you've got a solid architecture to your product for building it and deploying it and updating it, and you can apply some security mindset to that, that's the number one piece of advice, right?
Like, yeah.
Don't let it hold you back in the beginning. However, like building that awesome architecture, and it kind of goes back to an interview that we had on Enterprise Security Weekly with Signal Sciences. And, you know, Zane Lackey was like, the way we build software today is completely different. He's like, long gone are the days are like 18-month release cycles. He's like, your release cycles now could be daily. And when you're a startup, you have to think about your architecture as a whole. If you're doing daily software updates, you have to apply a security mindset to that. And if you do that, then your product security is going, not only probably going to be good from the get-go, but you're going to be able to more easily build in other security measures into that process if it's sound from the beginning.
Yeah, and the only maybe precursor I would add is this is where having that conversation makes sense. So by the way, some of the advice of, you know, contract a white hat hacker or choose a good password, I'm not saying that that's bad advice,
right.
but the way that it's offered is, I'm sorry, what the hell are you talking about? Here's the other piece that I didn't see too. Try to figure out how much of this is related to your product versus how much is related to your customers. What we do tend to see right now is a lot of startups are getting popped and a lot of small businesses are getting popped, not because of the business, but because of the customer information that they're storing. So when you're looking at your platform or you're developing your product, you also have to think at least briefly. And this is some of what I'm trying to get my head wrapped around for minimum viable security is how much customer information am I going to have? Are we going to have? How much do we need? Where are we going to store it? How are we going to protect it? Now, the good news is there might be an answer of we're not going to collect and store any of it. We're going to use Stripe. We're going to use something else, and we're good. All I want to see is, did you ask that question? And then once you've asked that question, you'll figure it out. So it's not that this advice is on its face the worst advice I've ever seen. It's just that it there's no sequence to it. And if you try to do all this stuff, you wouldn't be better off because there's no practical approach to it here at all. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of – it wasn't maddening. I didn't throw anything. It was just more of a we've just made computer security and cybersecurity more confusing to people, not less. We didn't advance the conversation.
The other article I had in here was 11 free tools and services that every first-time entrepreneur should use. I don't think this is that bad, Michael. I mean, basically, you know, they're suggesting a lot of free tools, some of which I didn't know existed. But I thought this was great from, you know, a marketing perspective and running your business lean from the start, which I think are two, you know, really great things. That you can do a lot of this for free. And some of the suggestions I had heard of, other ones I hadn't. And I thought, so it was good advice. Like free stock images, that was a good one too. What else was in here?
Pixabay. I the thing that's interesting is there's been a whole backlash in the industry around stock images. And when I say industry, I definitely don't mean the security industry, but the broader industry, because some of the stock photos, they look crazy. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen over the last year or two is there's a whole bunch of people that have said, you know what? Screw it. I'll tell you my favorites. Death to stock is good. If you're looking for something with some detail, there's one called the Morgue File. They're fantastic. Unsplash, we put up a story about them before. They're one of my go-tos and favorites. And then Pixabay, Pixabay. They are my new. They're my go-to, and they're growing and they're doing really well too. And I think they're great. I struggle now. The only thing I pay for from a stock perspective is the Noun Project. Mm-hmm. I think iconography is so much more powerful than just using pictures. Mm-hmm. And Noun Project's totally worth the price of admission for pro subscription. I have no qualms on that. I think this is a good list. Yeah, I think, to your point.
You know, one for me that I'm going to research that I have not used, but I can totally now see a use case for, especially as in my startup journey, I'm getting ready to see some initial revisions of the new interface. And as, you know, a founder or CEO of a startup with a very small development team, which is most of the startups, as you get started in information security, you're going to be in the situation. You have to communicate your vision of what the interface should look like to your developers. And right. That is a tricky process. And apparently there's tools that I didn't know about that can possibly help you do that. I'm going to try and use these tools to do that and report back on the show. So they say use Pencil to create your wireframes and use the free version of Marvel to create more realistic screens. That sounds like something a lot of startups can use, right, to do prototyping. So I like it.
Yeah, you know what, too? I'm going to be looking forward to your experience with that, because what I think is interesting is a lot of these companies have now said, all right, we get it. You don't need the full feature set. You don't need the full functionality. But we can give you this thing for free, and when you're ready and you see the power of it and you need more, yeah, we're here for you. So I'm going to be curious to see how the initial experience works for you. So if you don't mind, consider it from a how quick did it take me to get value from this? Did I get value from this? And is this something I continue using or not? I think that's going to inform both of our journeys and give everybody else a lot of insight as they go through all this type of stuff.
Absolutely. What was the other one I had in here?
TimeKit.
Yeah, this sounds easy. Really cool because, well, first of all, we've talked about booking systems
extensively.
We run a podcast, podcast network. We have a huge need for some kind of booking system. Right now, our booking system is, you know, a combination of Google Calendar and spreadsheets and things like that. Anytime we need to go create a spreadsheet, I cringe a little. But it, you know, it gets you by. Michael, you and most of us listening know this too, right? And sometimes it's hard to debate the power of a spreadsheet for a lot of things. However, there's a Danish firm called TimeKit. They just closed $1.7 million in seed funding. And
see, that's a big seed round.
That is a big seed round. And so let's say they're aimed at companies who want to build their own booking system so they can take bookings of various complexity online. Does this via an API and basically allows you to customize your booking system. I think not really researching this, but understanding the problem with this particular solution is that everyone has a custom need for a booking system. There's some kind of customization, and it's a lot of money if you're going to go hire a company or write it yourself. So I thought this startup was a good idea, and I thought their, as you pointed out, Michael, you know, their seed round was pretty hefty, which can give you, an inclination that they've got something good going on when their seed round is something in the, you know, upwards of $1 million.
Well, I'll tell you a couple of things that I'm pulling out as I'm looking at it. So I'm going to just read it from a TechCrunch article, and I like TechCrunch's reporting, especially in stuff like this. All right, so here's a quote from the co-founder and CEO. Quote, too many times online bookings flow are handled by outdated software solutions that are too rigid and too inflexible for a company's unique business needs.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So I'm kind of reading that going, yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, I think the larger the organization, the more you and I have been looking at some cloud systems that maybe I think are a little bit more flexible. And yet, even then, we both kind of scratched our head a couple times to figure out how we could do it better. So here's – but so there's the next two paragraphs in this are interesting. TimeKit developed a booking engine underpinned by modular software, and companies can build their own flows. So they can add payments. They can do custom reminders using webhooks. They can add or delete resources. They can build in complex availability rules. I like that. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about, even from a security perspective, is the difference, the distinction between building something modular and just kind of building a single purpose. And it sounds like they may have unpacked that. What that also tells me, though, is there's a lot of complexity to get that done right, and that may have required a bigger seed round. But then I like this. I'm curious. So how does this hit you? Typical TimeKit customer is the type of company for which a traditional booking system isn't suitable. This could be because of complex and unique scheduling needs that do not fit into the workflow of existing tools, or because they require the ability to make their booking systems appear native with the same look and feel as their own website and application. Yeah, is that you? Awesome. I mean, is that a fit? Like, that made sense, right? That resonated.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, for us, it's more of an internal tool than an external facing tool, depending on how you slice it. But yeah, I think that's a good idea. It's cool. So
yeah,
let's see
where it goes.
What's going on in your journey?
I had one of those great weeks. One of the things I've said all along is that the individuals are unique, and I've always embraced that. And what I've tried to explain, and I'll probably still work on the artfulness of the language, is that the uniqueness of your individual journey, straight talk, communication, leadership, anything, is not actually in conflict with some of the universal truths of that journey. How you get there might be different. What you do with it might be different. With the order that you acquire these skill sets and experiences, almost always going to be different. But what we start looking at is if you break down powerful communication or exceptional leadership, or in this case, straight talk, which delivers both of those, there's some fundamentals to it. The breakthrough I had this week was, as goes the individual, so goes the team, right? Because what's happened is, as I transitioned and I started working more with teams, I started realizing that it wasn't about developing leaders and communicators as much as it was taking friction out of communication. And as our hosts and our guests have explained to us over the last couple interviews, you've got to go in and ask customers what's working for them and listen to what they're telling you. Good news is I've taken their advice. And I listen to people say, you know, Michael, what's great about this is you're helping bring my team together and identify challenges. We're making better decisions faster. We're unlocking value quicker. And I was like, let me write that down. That's awesome. So here's what changed. I started working with teams. And then and as I've been working with the teams, what I realized first was that having an individual experience in the context of the team was really important. So what that means, Paul, is what most people do when they do some team level training is they say, okay, everybody, we're going to get together. It's Monday, and here's everything you need to know. Okay, good luck. And if it didn't make sense to you on an individual basis, yeah, it sucks. I mean, good luck. Well, what I do is I go, okay, we're going to use the straight talk framework. Here's the five questions. Here's the three perspectives. Here's the three rounds. Here's the common covenants and constraints. Here's where we're going to start. We got to really understand these questions. So here's our individual exercise, and I'm going to work with you one-on-one this week to make sure it makes sense. Oh, and here's our team exercise. So what you do individually is going to contribute to the team, and then we're going to make sense out of it both on an individual basis and on a team basis. By about the third week, oh man, you are watching neurons pop. Mm-hmm. Well, what I figured out this week is some teams need different things than other teams. It's one of those once you say
it. That's a great tagline for your business, Michael. Watching neurons pop. Yeah, I like that. Boom. I like that. Yeah, I like that. It's very.
So it's it was a week of figuring it out. So I'm at that point now where I've got to go refigure a couple things out. But all of a sudden, basically for me, Paul, it unlocked a pathway to take a team through what I call the simple start, 2 to 3 weeks, very low cost, very high speed, rapid results for them, but also lets me assess the team. We can get together. I built a new program called the Value Map. We sit down. We look at the Value Map. If it makes sense to continue working together, we got like an unlimited amount of options based on how we stack it. And suddenly it was like, oh, I can make real change and, wait for it, scale. Cool.
It's interesting.
So I was jazzed.
So last night, and we're going to get to my journey and how this impacts. And Michael, I got some homework for you too. So, Jason Blanchard, came on the Paul Security Weekly last night and probably could have been an interview on this show as well, because it's very applicable. Maybe we have to bring Jason on this show. I'd love for you two to brainstorm together, because I was like wishing you were there last night. Now, it's not a knock on your scheduling or anything, Michael, but just the content, I was like, oh, like Michael would really have some great insights into this. And Jason did, it wasn't a technical presentation. It was how to become a better storyteller as it relates to presenting.
Awesome.
In the security space. I was like, well, Michael has this thing about, you know, characters, conflict, and resolution. He's like, yes, but he broke it down into, and I have to go back and take notes on it. That's a sign of a good interview on the show as well, is when I have to, being the person that does the interview, still have to go back and take notes on what the person said. You know, inside baseball, as I'm asking a question, I'm hearing the answer, but I'm also trying to prep in my brain the next question. So a lot of times I'm not fully, like, you know, getting involved in the content as much as I do, so I have to go back and watch. Jason was one of he talked about, most importantly, I think, the hook, right? And I said, well, that's great for presentations. And he said, ask a question to engage your audience, right? And he's like, it'd be a simple question. Like, who here has attended ShmooCon before? I'm like, he's like, you want to get people's attention, right? He went into a lot of detail about that. But I kind of said, well, what about writing for a CFP? He's like, it's the same thing. He's like, when I write things, develop a presentation, he's like, I put the elements of like a hook and a climax and a conclusion. He's like, I write those words and then I fill it in. And I kind of took your conflict, characters, and resolution and applying that to getting to my journey, right? One of the things we're trying to do is establish the problems that we solve and bring those to the security community and establish ourselves as thought leaders, which I hate that word, but that's essentially what you have to do. So my presentations, I'm doing that, but also my CFPs, I'm doing that too. And then I'm like, well, this is great to apply to our sales pitches and our company pitches as well. So I, you know, we always need to go back, and do that never ending process of updating those materials. So, I thought it was really helpful. And that's kind of where I'm at in my journey, is submitting to some conferences, some presentations, that one of which is very strategic for, you know, the growth of our company. So
that's awesome. And what I would say too is that, what he laid out is not incompatible. When I always look at characters, conflict, and resolution, those are the three minimum sets of things that you need to have if you've got an effective story. So the way that that typically works is somebody goes, oh, I got this great story. So in 1984, I did this. In 1990, I did this. And no, those are facts. There's no emotion. I don't know who's involved. I don't understand your struggle. I don't know how it's better as a result of it. But when he's talking about setting a hook and bringing people into it and then bringing them there's a couple different stories. They call them story formats or story journeys. There's about seven basic types. Oh yeah, that's all solid. He's got a lot more detail around how to make some of those things work. But what he really nailed based on what you just relayed back was, you need that in a CFP. I saw a tweet the other day, and it doesn't really matter, except for the person said, don't say what you'll do, tell them what they'll get. Mm-hmm. And it was right, except for some of the language was, you know, as a result of this talk, you will. And I thought, oh, you know what though? There's a subtle art to being able to say, I'm going to share this experience in order to inform this outcome. And that helps you do X. But to state up front, you will learn this in a 1-hour keynote for a CFP, tread lightly. So there's a nuance to it. There's a nuance to all of this. There's no right answer. There's a lot of pathways. And I'd say it's always going to come down to context. I'll look at the interview. That'll be great. And then, let's bring them on. I will always have this conversation. Yeah. I love it.
No, I know I'm going to share my I have three talks that I'm preparing for this year, maybe even That's into awesome. Next year. So I'll share with you my CFPs. And a lot of this stems from, I got my first ever rejection from a CFP. So that kind of like motivated me to really apply all of those other things I learned about, you know, giving presentations to the CFP and underscoring the importance of it. So.
That makes a lot of sense. Hey, one more piece. I put out a point of view this week on threat modeling and with Archie Agarwal, and he will be joining us on the program to talk about threat modeling. And we're going to dig into a little bit what it's like for him as a startup, but we're also going to dig in a little bit too around if and how startups and security professionals can use threat modeling, perhaps a little different than we're using it today. This is something it's fascinating because a lot of people recognize a lot of my work around leadership and communication, but I've been in security for 20 years. I used to train people in crypto, and the threat modeling to me has always been fascinating, but it's always felt cumbersome. And so anybody who's passionate about it that can help us streamline it and start to make it more accessible, I'm excited. But I also know with your background, I think it's something to look forward to. So I just wanted to call out if people want to get a head start on preparing it, maybe even submit some questions to us.
Be awesome.
Love to look at your questions and start working with our guests on that a little bit too. So things are going well.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. Thanks, everyone, for listening and watching to this edition of Startup Security Weekly. See everyone next time.